So just to get started right away, I'm going to define the topic, define our problem that we have in South Dakota. I'm going to go over the use of some of the amendments and cover crops that we've used to try to manage this issue that we have in South Dakota. And then I'll talk a little bit about the summary and the recommendations. This is a problem that is plaguing South Dakota and something that has grown over the years. Many of the growers that I visit with, when we go out and look at new sites to use for research with farmers, it's all on-farm research. They'll tell me that when 25 years ago, when I started farming, these areas in my field were the very best areas, and now I can't grow anything there. And each year, these areas increase in size, and so we have done some research with a number of graduate students at SDSU, South Dakota State University, in trying to address these problems with the tools that we currently have. And so I will summarize the recommendations that we have come up with based upon our project. Okay, so in order to give you an idea about our issues here, I'm going to take you back in time when we start to start my presentation and give you an idea of why do we have these problems and why they are here in South Dakota. So 65 to, do I have a pointer here or a mouse? Right here? Okay, so you know, 65 to 140 million years ago, we had a shallow inland sea that was over much of eastern and western South Dakota, and this laid down shales. So this image is from the U.S. Geological Survey, and the green area here is northeastern South Dakota, right in through here, and you'll see here that our formation there that was laid down by the ocean is a pure shale, is predominant, is the green, and then the Niobrara Formation. Now this was laid down in a marine environment, and so if we look at these here, these contain different types of, you know, shale, bentonite, sandstone, in both of these, and they predominate basically in the north central area of South Dakota here. So these were laid down during, you know, millions of years ago, present over a long period of time. Then we're going to fast forward millions of years in South Dakota, and we're going to come to the Wisconsin Glaciation Epoch, which we had areas here in South Dakota. I drew them our borders here for our county, here for our states right in through here. Brookings is right here, and pretty much the area, the extent to our salinity issues are associated with this James Loeb of this glaciation event. And this occurred about 12,000 or so years before present. So the impact on the present day soils that have been deposited here is very significant as a result of this past. The electrical conductivity of ocean water is between 35 and 40 decisiemens per meter, very, very high. And so we've had periods of advancing and retreating glaciation coming down from Canada, you know, going over the Canadian Shield, scouring that, bringing down material from those igneous granite deposits, and then coming over South Dakota where we had those old formations of shale and limestone there. And so we have we have a very diversified till that's been deposited where these glaciers existed, came through. Also, too, we do have in north central South Dakota where a lot of our problems are localized. We used to have an old glacial Lake Dakota in north central South Dakota. So all of these factors work together to provide a highly variable soil landscape in eastern South Dakota, where we can see variability, you know, intense variability from meter to meter in different locations in the field in our salt content. Okay, and so this is a map. I didn't put the scale on there because there's a lot of different colors in there, but the extent areas is, you know, really in through here. Here's that old glacial Lake Dakota. And this is the old glacial moraine right here. This is where the moraine was. This was the finger here where the lobe did not extend here. So in this area of South Dakota, these counties here, we don't see the issues with the saline and sodic soil. So that's one key background position, factor that occurred. The next thing here is just I took a little area in eastern South Dakota, and I wanted to show you a time sequence from 1973 to 1977 to 2013. So here, I could not find any good imagery, but here's an old map from 1973. There's a farm site right down here and this is Lynn Lake. So this is in the area where we do have some of these issues with soils, and you'll see the footprint of Lynn Lake over here, and then another little lake over here, 1973. So then we move over to 1977. We saw a lot of increase in rainfall in the 80s and the 90s, and a lot of snowfall as well. And so this prairie pothole region started to fill up. And now you can see what the footprint is here for the old Lynn Lake is right here. These two areas here. But you can see the extent of the water that's beginning to fill this area. My farm place here is still accessible. I'm going to move on to 2013. Here's my little farm place that I kind of tried to pop in down here. Here's our old footprint for these lakes right here that used to be here. And you can see in a very, really short geological time period that we've really increased the amount of water in our area. All right, so what does that mean? So here's that site that I show you here up in that area. So, you know, we've had a massive increase in the last 20 to 30 years in our precipitation. And so what's happened that's brought our groundwater up? So the salts are there in the till and in the deposits below. It's our water tables come up, dissolve many of those salts that are highly soluble, and now we've changed our management. And so what we've done is we've switched to a lot of these areas from native prairie, which has a very dense, fibrous, deep root system, and to corn, a soybean, and a wheat rotation. And so we've changed our water capacity used for our plants as well. So these three factors have led to the problems that we see in eastern South Dakota. Okay. And so the capillary rise then brings these salts up to the surface, dissolved in the water because of the till that's there. And we see these salts then evaporate, water evaporates, and these salts are left on the surface. And it looks like snow, you know, out in the fields in June, but it's not. Okay, so the problems that we have here are basically calcium, magnesium, and sodium salts. With either of these salts, all three of these salts, we change the osmotic potential of the soil, and so seeds have difficulty germinating. The added problem that we see here with our sodic salts is that our soils are dispersed. And so we have a lot of erosion problems with that as well. The commonality that we have is that high water table. So we look at trying to manage that high water table. That's one tool that we can use. Okay. Like I said, here's a picture of a field in eastern South Dakota that we worked on, and these channels were cut in one spring. So the erosion potential in these areas is very significant because we have bare soil in the spring going in with no cover coming in. Okay, so the extent of the problem, now we estimate that we have about 32.2% of eastern South Dakota soils are underlying with these saline or these sodic types of conditions. So we've seen significant yield losses, and like I said, these areas expand every year, and our producers are like, what can we do about it? So then we started looking at, let's go to the USDA ARS Salinity Lab out of California, the recommendations, and let's use what they have, because they have to manage a lot of salty soils in California. So when we look at this here, electrical conductivity is what we use to measure total salts, calcium, magnesium, and sodium salts. The benchmark that we use is if the EC is greater than 4 decisiemens per meter squared, we classify that as a saline soil. All three salts are present. We do this on a saturated paste extract. Sodium, we have two options to test for sodium. We can either test with the sodium absorption ratio, the SAR, or the estimated percent sodium. The SAR is the benchmark method that is used to establish these parameters. A lot of labs do not use that because it is a time-consuming process, and so they're using exchangeable sodium percent. So there's a discrepancy here between the soil testing that I don't have time to address, okay? All right, so we learned in South Dakota that 13 does not work for an SAR. We see dispersion at 5, so our values that we're going to use is an EC of 4 and a sodium ratio of 5. Okay, and so then we went and looked at amendments and cover crops to try to help manage and mediate these areas. We had three sites in South Dakota: Pierrepont, Redfield, and White Lake. Our treatments were none. Our amendments were none: gypsum, elemental sulfur, or calcium chloride. We split these plots then as cover crop treatments using barley and sugar beets. They were interseeded into the crop or bare ground at approximately June 25th. Soybeans, they were planted at about the B6 to R1. If we had corn, it was R5 to R6. Okay. Here's what we did. We established the plots out in the field. This is what it looked like in the field. You know, nothing grows there. There's our gypsum application up here. And then we tilled it in. In some places we had corn growing. All the plots were tilled. So every plot was tilled, so we didn't have an effective non-tillage there. The site baseline data, Redfield had an EC of 8, an SAR of 5. We classified that as a saline. There was no dispersion on the surface. White Lake had an EC of 11, an SAR of 12. We had dispersed surface. Pierpont was our kind of standout area. We had 19. We had very high sodium, an SAR of 19, and a very dispersed soil that looked like concrete. I'm going to kind of skip this slide over. It gives you some of the rates. I don't have time to go over that, just some of the cost analysis. Here's what we saw. At White Lake in 2013, we had sorghum as a crop. In 14, we did not have a yield because there was a crop growing there, but there was an error with the farmer that occurred there. In 2015, we had corn. In Redfield, we had 2013, we had corn. In 14 and 15, we had soybeans. At Pierpont, we had no crop, and we had a little bit of corn that grew up at Pierpont in 2015. Just going to go over some of the results that we see here. Average yield for corn in our area is about 180 to 200 bushels per acre. We were about half that at the Redfield 2013. The application of some high salt rates did not seem to affect the yield compared to where we did not have it versus where we did. The standout here is for when we saw this here where we had the cover crop. We saw a slightly increased yield there. Okay. Cover crops, just to summarize that. Redfield corn year 2013 was the only year that we had cover crops grow in the least sodic environment. White Lake, no cover crops. Pierpont, some cover crops. There's a typo there in corn. The only annuals that survived were barley and sugar beets harvested in Redfield in 2013 corn. This is what it looked like right there, growing in that. And remember here, barley and sugar beets are very salt tolerant, so we expect to have some success germinating this year. Our amendments here did not have any impact on the cover crop germination. The cover crops did not have an impact on yield. And the sugar beets here, the sulfur appeared to have a slightly highly average yield, but was not statistically significant. Our Redfield corn and soybean yield, we did not see an impact carryover of those amendments on our yield. The yields were about the same, no significant difference, about half of what it would normally be. White Lake, we saw, once again, not an impact with any of the amendments, either with the sorghum or the corn. The sorghum yielded a little bit better because, once again, it's more salt tolerant. Pierpont, what we did see here is in 2005, we saw at 0.1, if we would have analyzed this at 0.1, we saw a little bit better yield with the gypsum. So in 2014, when the amendments were applied in 2014, that year corn yield a year and a half later was 37, a little bit higher than the rest. Okay. One thing that we did observe here, here is an area in Pierpont where we have these salts. Top picture, no cover crop salts on the surface. Chloride here, some cover crops, salts on the surface right here. Down here we had gypsum. We could see some of the road cover crops, the barley and the sugar beets germinating. Fewer salts on the surface, elemental sulfur right here. Okay. So old Pierpont site, the amendment was applied in fall 2013. We drilled sugar beets and barley, seeded in about June 24th. Rainfall June 30th, approximately 1 inch, full and steady. Picture July 7th, hot, dry the rest of the summer, small seedlings died. So we see that, you know, we're at least where we have the elemental sulfur, it appears that we changed some of the chemistry of the soil to allow germination, but we're not successful in growing the rest of that. Okay, so I'm going to go to my conclusions here, basically right, what we saw. I have 5 minutes or I'm done. 5 minutes? Okay. We have salties. Oh, I just mentioned one thing here, too. So when we looked at these values here, this is an important table. When we looked at the initial baseline data here for each one of these sites, and then we looked at our salt treatment, looking at did we change our sodium absorption ratio right here, it appears that we lowered it a little bit potentially with our amendments right here, from a 4 to about a 2. But remember, this is not a sodic area. Where we had our sodium areas here, it appears that we lowered it a little bit. applied in fall of 2013, sampled 2 years later, we went from a 17 to a 15. Okay. So we have these salty soils in South Dakota. They're very difficult to manage. They can change meter to meter. The remediation of these areas is very, very difficult. The amendments do not work as quickly as what we look at, what we think. We need to soil test that area to determine if sodium is a problem. If sodium is a problem, then we probably have a different management that we have to implement than if we have a saline issue. Like I said, our amendments have been slow to work over the 2 to 4 years of the study. I do believe that this is a long-term process. The one picture that I had there was the elemental sulfur in the soil. When we would a soil sample, when we look at the prills there in an area, that you could still see the elemental sulfur prills 2 years later. And so the next study that we're going to work on here is looking at the biological activity of those soils. The one study where we saw some growth there with the cover crops at Redfield in the saline environment and the germination of the cover crops in the sodic environment, you know, how did we change some of the soil biology there with that root in there? Tiling makes sense in some of these saline areas. We need to be cautious about sodium because it can disperse those lower level horizons. Salt-tolerant perennial crops we think will work. That's another project that we are working on, lowering that water table. Annual cover crops, no, definitely a no for saline and sodic soils. So with that, I thank the funding and the people that I've worked with on this project, our farmers and our CS people and our graduate students.
Thanks, Joe, for the presentation.